This is Joanna Klohesi, an intern with John Lothian News, and today I am speaking with none other than John Lothian upon his recent induction to the FIA Hall of Fame about his career and what has brought him to this notable accomplishment.
Where are you from?
I grew up in Glenview, Illinois. Went to grade school and middle school and high school there. But my family spent all of our summers up in Williams Bay, Wisconsin. And it was there that I learned a lot of different things, learned how to sail, learned how to swim, learned a lot about independence as I had a lot of free time. And it was there that played Little League Baseball, and my brothers played Little League Baseball. It was there that the coach of my older brother was a neighbor of ours who was a Board of Trade member, who became a mentor of mine when I started working for him.
Where did you attend university and what did you major in?
So I attended Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, and I followed my brother there, my older brother, Scott, who was there getting a pharmacy degree. Scott was 2.5 years older than me, and I had looked at a lot of different schools, and I wanted a bigger school, but I wanted a smaller big school. And Purdue presented that. And there was also a familiarity with Purdue that I really liked. However, when I applied to the Credit School of Management, they didn't let me in. And I got what was known affectionately at the time as a ding letter. And so I went to my counselor in high school and she said, well, why don't you apply to the ag school? And I said, okay, you can do that? And she said, yeah, apply to the ag school, take the same courses that you would as a management student, and then transfer over after your first semester when you get some good grades. I said, sure, okay. So I applied to the ag school and they let me in. And so I went to Purdue, lived in Cary Quadrangle, which at the time was the largest all-male dormitory in the nation. And I lived in a room that was made for one person, and it had two people in it. And I didn't hit it off right away with my roommate, who I convinced to, with some other people on the dorm, to take a room across the hall that had opened up. And so I ended up without a roommate for about a day. And then the school found a new roommate for me. And I ended up in the management school. And then I was writing for the school newspaper. And I liked that so much that I decided to pursue a degree in journalism as well. Now, Indiana University has the journalism school in Indiana. So Purdue at the time had what they called the communications degree with a concentration in journalism that was part of the humanities, social sciences, and education school, HSSE. It's now the College of Liberal Arts. So I applied to the HSSE school because I couldn't get a double major because it was two different schools, and one was a Bachelor of Arts and one was a Bachelor of Science. And so I had to get two separate degrees from Purdue, which actually worked out really well. When you go to school, you will often find that you can't get into the classes that you want because you didn't get registered fast enough for them. And what I found was that I was able to get into my management classes through slots in the humanities school and get into humanities slots through the slots in the management school. It took me all of 10 semesters to get the two degrees. And so I was there a summer and an extra fall to graduate.
So how did you get started with finance?
Well, when I was a sophomore in high school, I took a class called Chicago. And in this class, we visited various institutions and neighborhoods around Chicago. One of the institutions that we visited was the Chicago Board of Trade. And I was fascinated by the Board of Trade, as many people are when they visit it and they see all the people shouting and jumping up and down and all the colorful coats and all the paper flying around and everything. And it was in the visitors gallery overlooking the old 1929 trading floor. And I asked a member who had a yellow badge, which would be a full member of the exchange, how do you get a job here? And he said, well, it helps to know someone. And I said, I know Tom Cashman. And he said, that's a good person to know. And so Tom was the baseball coach of my brothers up in Wisconsin. And he had hired a friend of my brother's, a guy by the name of Joe Duffy, to be his driver in the summertime to drive him from Wisconsin into the city and back. And when I was 17, Tom had gotten Joe a job with a company called Hennessy and Associates as a phone man. And so Joe couldn't do the driving anymore. And so I heard that the job was open, and I walked over to Tom's house and I said, I hear you're looking for a driver. I have a driver's license. I'm a good driver and I'd like to apply for the position. So Tom hired me, and I did that all throughout the rest of my high school years and into college. And so during that time, I fell in love with the markets. I fell in love with journalism at the same time because I was fascinated by the way that the markets absorbed information, consumed it, and came up with this thing called price. And so that was one of the reasons why I decided to pursue a degree in finance from Purdue.
Were there any other professions or paths for your life that you considered before deciding on the futures industry?
Actually, there was. So when I was in high school, and as I was looking at college, considering going into the ministry, I was very active in my church, and I had a very influential minister there who I respected greatly. And I was very into my faith, and I liked that idea. And so when I went to Purdue, I decided that I would kind of pursue a dual path, one in finance and one with the ability to go into the ministry. And one of the reasons why I didn't, just go and study philosophy at Purdue was you get out and what are you going to do? Open a philosophy shop? Don't go into the ministry. So I figured that, church is like a business in some ways. You have a lot of things that are very similar to it. And so the finance degree would come in handy if I was running a church. It would also be handy relative to connecting with the business people that were members of the church. The communication skills that I learned from being a student journalist would be helpful in terms of being a minister, in terms of writing sermons or messages for the church, for the newsletters or whatever messages were going out. So I was developing skills that were good for both of them. When I was a freshman, I started going to University Church, which was a multi-denominational campus ministry. And so it had five or six different denominations that were all together in this one kind of campus ministry. So it was the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the UCCs and the Church of the Brethren and the Quakers and also the Disciples of Christ. And so my sophomore year, the church got some funding for a new program that was essentially ministry to students in the dormitories. And so they hired a student to help students in the dormitories with whatever problems that they had or bring them to church or so I got hired for Cary Quadrangle, was very successful in that in terms of bringing a bunch of students to University Church and getting them involved and being a resource for people over there. And then the next year, I got hired as a what was called a student associate in ministry, and I was in charge of the worship services. And so I was in charge of making sure that we had people to be liturgists and musicians and and all of that. And so that was a fun experience. And so I was kind of preparing myself for the possibility of going into the ministry. And I had that decision to make after I graduated from college as to what did I want to do? Did I want to go into the markets or did I want to go into the ministry? And I remember visiting with a lot of different people to discuss that. And one friend of my dad's who had been a minister and had left the ministry to go into business told me that you can do a lot of good in a church as a lay person, and you don't have to be a minister in order to contribute to the church. And so that kind of made up my mind that I wanted to make sure that I wasn't making a mistake by not trying the markets. And so I tried the markets and to make sure I had no regrets. And I fell in love with them and had a career.
So after college, what was the next step for you? Where did you end up?
I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to work for a company called Commodity News Service. And they were one of the wire services that covered the markets at the Chicago Board of Trade. The other wire service was a company called Reuters, which is still around today. Commodity News Service was owned by a company called Knight Ridder, which is not around today. But Knight Ridder owned Commodity News Service, and they covered the futures markets. And I had asked my brother's friend, Joe Duffy, who was working on the floor for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange for Harris Bank, if he knew the floor reporter over there. And he did, and it was a woman by the name of Cece Rogers. And so got her number, and I talked to her, and she told me that the bureau chief in Chicago was a guy by the name of Bob Bogda, and that they did have a job open for a financial reporter in Chicago. And so the day after my last exam at Purdue, I went to Bob Bogda's office in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And I knocked on the door and I said, "Hello, my name's John Lothian, and I'd like to work for you." And so we had a conversation and he set up some interviews for me where he interviewed me and then where I was interviewed by all of the staff, all the other reporters of Commodity News Service in Chicago. And the job came down to me and a woman by the name of Suzanne Cosgrove. And Suzanne was a little bit older than me, and she was working on a master's degree at McGill School of Journalism at Northwestern, where Cece Rogers was also working on a master's degree. And Cece was the head of the financial desk at that point. So they ended up hiring Suzanne. Anyway, a couple months later, they had a new opening, and this was that they were moving their coverage of the Minneapolis Grain Exchange and closing the office up there in Minneapolis and moving it to Chicago. And so they hired me to cover the markets in Chicago as well as the markets in Minneapolis. And so I got to work with Suzanne. And ironically, years later, I ended up hiring her to work for John Lothian and Company. So the woman that got the job I wanted right out of school, I hired. The job at Commodity News Service was great. It was a great first job. However, it didn't last very long. And it didn't last very long, not because of anything I did, but because of great change within the markets. And so 9 months after I started the position, I was let go along with a couple of other reporters at the exact same moment in different offices around the company. And what was happening was there was great change happening in the industry. So during the late 1970s, there were some large, what we call bull markets in the grain markets and in the metals markets. And as a result of that, there was a huge buildup of capacity within the commodity markets. And that means we hired a lot of people on the trading floors. We hired a lot of brokers out in the sticks to be able to service clients that were interested in the markets. As a result of that, there was a lot of abuse of customers by by different brokers. And some of those things happened out in places where there weren't compliance officers overlooking the brokers. And so the firms were getting sued, and they were what are called the deep pockets because they had all the money. And so they went to Congress and they said, hey, we need a new organization here in terms of how the industry is structured because we're getting killed by these lawsuits. Okay. At the same time, the exchanges were going to Congress and saying, hey, we need a new organization for the industry because we're introducing new products that aren't agricultural or metal or traditional products futures had been traded on. So they were introducing financial futures, for example, foreign currency futures and bonds and notes and things like that, and eventually stock index futures and more. And so the industry needed a new regulator because up to that time, the regulation had been overseen by the Agriculture Department and also it had been overseen by the Agriculture Committee, the Senate and the House level. And of course, the House and Senate Financial Services Committee like to oversee the financial markets, right? And so the Commodity Exchange Act was created in the early 70s to create the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which was a new regulator. And within that, then, there was the ability to create what was called a self-regulatory organization, an SRO. And that SRO was something called the National Futures Association. And that was created in 1982. And so as the National Futures Association was starting to get ramped up and hire people and create rules and regulations and all of this, it basically created the structure for a new model for brokerage firms where they would be what are now called futures commission merchants and introducing brokers. And so these brokerage firms were what were called wirehouses back in the day because they had all these offices all over the place that were connected by wires, you know, and that would send in their orders over the wires. They fired all their brokers, okay, in the commodity world. In fact, Merrill Lynch went from 100 commodity offices down to 2. And as you can imagine, a lot of these commodity offices had commodity news service machines in it. And so commodity news services all of a sudden saw this sharp drop in sales of their machines. And so that was one of the reasons why they cut back in terms of the number of reporters that they had, was because of this industry change that was happening in terms of the number of demand for their machines because of the number of brokers that were out there. Now, all of those brokers eventually, or most of them, went to became introducing brokers or formed futures commission merchants themselves and, you know, became part of the industry again in different ways. And so there was a new renaissance, as it were, that was part of that whole regulatory change. But the first part was a brutal part that cost me my first job. Let me just take the next step for you. So after I left Commodity News Service, I went to a discount brokerage house by the name of First American Discount. And so one of the changes that was occurring at the time, this big change in the markets, was the change from kind of fixed pricing of commissions to floating commissions. And so you saw that in the stock market where you had discount houses like Charles Schwab and E-Trade and firms like that, you know, come in. And in the futures industry, you had firms like First American Discount or Lynn Waldock or other firms that came in. And so I went to work for First American Discount, which was founded by a guy by the name of William J. Mallers Sr., who had been chairman of the Board of Trade in 1969. And Mallers was kind of a rogue chairman back then, ran against the slated candidate. And then he became kind of the political godfather of the Board of Trade for the next 15 years and ultimately had a little bit of a falling out and left the exchange and came back and did this brokerage firm business with his kids, because he had two sons and a daughter that were working in this business. And so I worked there, and he taught a bunch of us to trade. And so I learned how to trade futures from Bill Mallers Sr. using what was called the market profile system that was developed by Peter Stottlemyre. And I had the most success of anybody at First American Discount in terms of trading. And they had planned to do a fund that I would trade. And that was the plan until all of a sudden the 1987 stock market came along. And the 1987 stock market crash cost me my job at First American for about a week. And then I got rehired. And ultimately, it was kind of the beginning of the end for me at First American. I actually had been fired and rehired like 3.5 times there. Mallers was a very volatile figure. And yeah, so it was kind of difficult. But I learned to trade. And so when I left First American, I went to a proprietary trading firm at a firm called LIT America. And LIT was a British firm that had come in and bought a bunch of Chicago brokerage firms. And they backed a trading group called Meltdown Trading. And they had hired me in 1989 to be an off-the-floor futures trader because they were afraid of electronic trading coming in and closing down the trading floors. About 5 days into my tenure as a futures trader there, the FBI investigation of the markets came in and screwed up the markets for everybody. And so everybody lost money for a couple of months. And I finally started making money and was grinding it out, grinding it out, grinding it out. LIT came in and reorganized the group and got rid of the off-the-floor traders, which included me. And I was out on my own again. Tom Cashman, who had been my mentor and who I drove for, he had a membership that he bought from the Mid-America Commodity Exchange that he gave to me to use. And so I used that to trade on the floor of the Mid-Am. And the Mid-America Commodity Exchange had smaller size contracts. So if the Board of Trade had a 5,000 bushel contract of soybeans, the Mid-Am had a 1,000 bushel contract. And if the bonds had a $100,000 bond, it was a $50,000 bond face value that the Mid-Am had, stuff like that. So, but the markets were very quiet when I was a Mid-Am member, and I couldn't make enough money to stay down there. And I eventually left and became a broker. I became a full service commodity broker at a company called Gerald Commodities. And I called some people that I knew from my First American days, whose numbers I just recalled off the top of my head, and opened up some accounts. And then I just started cold calling people, numbers from people that had called the exchange asking for information or different lead sources or whatever it was, and trying to find customers. And I had some success. I was making a little bit of a living. I found some decent customers. And then the company that I was working for, Gerald, decided to sell itself to one of its customers, a guy by the name of Monroe Trout, who was a big hedge fund guy. As part of that, they decided to get rid of people that had made claims against the health insurance because they were self-insured for the first $100,000 or $1 million or something like that. And so I spent one night in the hospital because I had some stomach problems. And so they let me go. They let go also a guy by the name of Bud Frazier, whose wife had had a quadruple bypass. And Bud was a former vice chairman of the Board of Trade, and he started a new firm. And I got hired by Bud's new firm over at the Board of Trade. And so I was able to keep my clients at this new firm that was formed out of my old firm and all. And I was growing my business under Bud. And then Bud got sick and developed leukemia. And within 9 months of me joining him, he died. And not only that, but the same week that he died, a broker in his office blew up the firm to the tune of about $1.5 million. And so his family didn't want to continue the company. And so a couple of his longtime associates and I formed a new company. And all of a sudden, I'm a part owner of a company. And my margins have gone way down because I'm an owner of a company as opposed to having to pay middlemen above me. Well, that was great. And the blow up had occurred at a clearing firm called First Options of Chicago. And First Options of Chicago was in the midst of buying LIT America, as it turned out. And there was a guy at LIT by the name of Ryan McNally, who was from Northbrook, the sister town to Glenview, where I grew up. And in fact, I had been in a school play with his sister, who's a Hollywood actress now. And so I should have known Ryan, or, and his parents had a place up in Wisconsin like mine. And, so we should have been friends. And we became friends. And so he kind of became, my really good friend at the clearinghouse, and helped me a lot. And my business grew. And when new things came up, I became kind of his guinea pig for them. So I became an electronic trading pioneer through Ryan's help. Okay. In the old days on the trading floor, all the orders were handwritten, or they were printed on printers from wire service, warehouses, and run into the trading pit. And so there was, as the internet was starting, there was a move towards electronic order routing. And one of the systems that the exchanges developed was called TOPS, for Trade Order Processing System. And back in those days, this trade order processing system used to run off of what was called dumb terminals. Okay, so this is way before your time, but the dumb terminals meant that you had a dedicated terminal that did just this like one function type of thing. So if you wanted to go into this order routing system that sent orders down to the trading floor, you had to use this one monitor and this one keyboard. And so there was a lot of questions about, space on your desktop and all that kind of stuff, right? So I was actually the first broker at this firm to have an emulation program that emulated the box on my Windows 95 computer. And because of that, I was able to send orders directly down to the trading floor. And as the new E-mini S&P came out, where it was a market that was purely electronic, I had direct access to this electronic market. My business expanded because I had this great access, because I was faster and didn't have to spend time calling people and all this kind of stuff. And that was great. However, my business partners, one of them had a client, and I found a $1 million problem with their account, where they were defrauding their employer. And we had a disagreement over how to handle this problem. And so I ended up leaving the company. And so I moved down the hall to a company I had been doing a little business for, because I had this great access to the market. And it was a company called the Price Futures Group. And the Price Futures Group hired me as head of electronic trading. And this was right at the time when internet futures trading was just starting to happen. Okay. And in fact, Ryan had introduced me to some guys from the CME who had been developing a rogue project. It was a Java-based interface to trade over the internet for the CME. And so they needed somebody to do not beta, but alpha testing, right? So I was their alpha test. And then my clients were their beta test. And it was a free platform. And so I offered it to my clients, and I had clients trading on it. And to show how far back this was, the computer that this system ran on, it was a reused administrative assistance 286 computer that had been turned into a computer server. And it was in the Globex control center on a rack somewhere. And one day the system went black. My customers called up and they're like, "Hey, the system's down." And so I called my contact and somebody sent somebody over to look at the system. And it was because the people over at the Globex control center didn't know what the box did. And so they unplugged it. Anyway, so I'm at the price group and I offer some other trading platforms. I was the one that got Man Group to offer M-Trade or Pat Systems, I should say. I was the one that got MF Global, which Man Group became when they went public, to offer CQG. But as I was at the price group and the markets are changing dramatically as electronic trading is starting to become more predominant. There was so much change happening in the industry and nobody could keep up with it. And so what I started to do was I started a newsletter at the time. And so I started collecting all of the press releases from the exchanges and stories about what was happening in the industry and putting them together in an email and sending them out to my clients and friends and colleagues. Now, part of this was that I'm trying to help them manage the change that was occurring, but it was also that I wanted to network with people in the industry. Because I was selling a managed futures product, but I was also afraid of changes that were occurring because there was a new product that was being talked about called single stock futures. And I wasn't sure how that was going to impact the industry, and in particular, how that was going to impact introducing brokers that didn't trade stocks, which is what we were. And so so I started this newsletter and as a way to get my name out there and to network with people and to help grow my business. And for a long time it did, until it didn't, which is when people started seeing me more as a journalist than as a broker. And also the other thing happened was that as electronic trading became more prevalent, prices for commission rates started to go down and down and down. And I didn't want to go down there to those low prices because I didn't like the risk reward for it. And so my income from brokerage started going down and my income from the newsletter, which I started charging for, started to go up. Now, 2005, maybe it was, Richard Sandor, who was the guy that created the 30-year bond with his economics team at the Board of Trade. He said to Jim Carruth, a journalist in Chicago, but at a conference in Switzerland, "Hey, wouldn't it be great if there was a newsletter in carbon trading like John Lothian's in derivatives trading?" And Jim tried to get a newsletter off the ground, but never did. And I was very supportive of it. But one day I called him up and I said, "Hey, where's your newsletter? I have 15 stories in my newsletter today about environmental trading." And he said, "Well, you've seen it. It's still on the drawing board." And I said, "Well, here's the thing. If you don't do something, I'm going to." I said, "How about we do something together? Take that section of my newsletter, blow it up, have you edit it, send it out, and we'll send out my newsletter along with that section so the people learning about carbon trading can learn about the futures and securities markets and vice versa." And so we negotiated a deal down in Miami at the options conference to create Environmental Markets Newsletter. And Jim was working as a freelancer, but he was the main freelancer for FOW out of London. And so he had a full-time job, essentially. And so he needed some help. And so we ended up hiring a woman that was an assistant professor over at DePaul to do the search for the stories for the newsletter. And then Jim would put it together and then send it out every night. And so we started to take some advertising in order to do that. And then in 2007, John Maddy, who I'd met on the internet back in 1995 and who I had signed up as he was a commodity trading advisor and a broker, and I'd signed him up to raise some money for him and would raise the money. And eventually I ended up buying his business from him. He had gotten divorced and left the business. And anyway, he wanted to come back to the business. And he said, "Hey, John, I want to work for you." And so I looked at the business as it existed, and I hadn't established a 3-year track record yet where I felt comfortable raising new money for it. And it wasn't producing enough income to be able to hire him outright. And so I looked at the media business at the time. And 2007 was a transformative time in the media business. So mainstream media was bankrupt, both strategically and financially. Newspapers were shutting down. They were shutting down their paper editions. They were closing. They were bankrupt. The Sun-Times and the Tribune both sold. Wall Street Journal sold. And, you know, and people were looking for new models. Less people were reading the paper and newspaper, and more people were getting their information from the internet. And then there was a line on Michigan Avenue that year for not a copy of the Chicago Tribune from Tribune Tower, but a thing called an iPhone from the Apple Store. And that really changed the way that people got information as they bought the iPhone. And so the other thing that happened in 2007 was there is a guy by the name of Jimmy Wales. And Jimmy Wales had been a trader, a futures trader with CTC. And he then got into publishing and eventually started something called Wikipedia. And he said that his software was so important to mankind and civilization for the creation of knowledge bases, collaboration, and sharing, that he was going to give it away for free, the software that powered Wikipedia, which is called MediaWiki. And so I said, sold. And I went and I looked up and looked for a domain name for something. And I came up with the name of MarketsWiki. And so I went to the Florida FIA Boca Conference in March. And I didn't have a scrap of paper. I didn't have a logo. I didn't have anything. I just had a story about how, you know, I had successfully launched a couple of newsletters. The John Lothian newsletter was like the must-read newsletter in the industry. And there was this change going around, and we needed new places to advertise. And the other change that was happening was 2007 was a lot of people were leaving the trading floor as futures moved to electronic trading. And we were losing intellectual capital from the trading floor as that happened. And so it used to be that if you wanted to know anything, you just called the trading floor and you just asked to talk to somebody on the trading floor. Well, now people were Googling things. And one of the top three entries that you would get when you'd Google something was typically from Wikipedia. And so I decided that if we built our own wiki that had industry terms and companies and people and things like that, that it would organically show up high within Google searches when people looked for this stuff. And so that's the origin of Markets Wiki and how it got started. And people just started throwing money at me for me to build this. And because mainstream media was bankrupt, I was able to hire a lot of very good journalists to help build the site and then establish a company and establish a culture and establish a culture of innovation that still permeates the company today.
Did you have any idea when starting it that it would turn into something this big?
I did not, although make no small plans. And so I knew that when you start something that has no end, that it can get pretty big. A wiki in and of itself is like a term paper that never ends. So I knew that it was a big project and it was going to take a lot of work, and it needed the right people to be able to do that. What was interesting was the opportunities that came as the result of that kept coming our way. So for example, the New York Stock Exchange came to me and they said, John, we're about to buy the metals contracts from the CME that the Board of Trade had, because they were the CME was about to buy the NYMEX, which had the COMEX metals contracts. And so they couldn't have both. And so they wanted me to start a metals newsletter. And so I wrote a proposal for a metals newsletter that they sponsored and put a fairly hefty number on it. And they signed a contract for it. And so I was able to hire my nephew, Ryan, who was working for a company called Ocean Tomo. And Ocean Tomo sold intellectual property through auctions and the like. They had grander ambitions and all. But when the financial crisis hit in 2007 and 8, everybody went to sell intellectual property instead of buy it. And Ocean Tomo then ended up selling their business to a company called ICAP. And then they laid off their staff in Chicago, including my nephew, Ryan. Well, he had developed a whole new media marketing plan for Ocean Tomo. He was working on a new media degree at DePaul at the time, which was new media, and at the time, and it would be called Web 2.0 or social media today or whatever, right? But it was new media at the time. Social media hadn't even, been coined yet, right? And so he brought this plan over to us, and I was able to utilize that for the metals newsletter. And then I was very opportunistic about reaching out to people when they were let go from companies and asking them to if they wanted to work a little bit on Markets Wiki. And so there was a journalist that had been let go by Futures Magazine that was doing some work for us. And I'm like, if something bigger comes along, maybe we can do more. And 2 days later, we've got this deal with NYSE. And so was the first editor of the metals newsletter. And then because of what we were doing with the new media stuff, we decided to start some blogs on interest rates and one on managed futures and one on options. And as a result of that, NYSE came back to us and said, hey, I see you have a blog on options. We'd like to sponsor that. And we've got the Price Group to sponsor our managed futures newsletter. The blog turned into a newsletter, and they sponsored that. And then we got CME Group to sponsor the interest rate newsletter. And then we did an FX newsletter. And so we had seven different newsletters at one point. New York Stock Exchange came to me and they said, hey, there's this Dodd-Frank bill that came out and there's too much information and nobody has their arms around it. And you're really good at collaboration and sharing. You should do something. And I'd already thought up the idea of a wiki for it and gotten the name Markets Reform Wiki. And so that's when we hired Doug Ashburn and we started that project. And so we were able to create a wiki that organized the information that was coming out about that. That one of the top domains that went into it was actually the CFTC, which meant that we were organizing their information better than they were. So if they were looking for the information, they were looking for it on our site rather than theirs. We just kept being opportunistic and doing things like that. And then we got into education, did a program called Markets Wiki Education, World of Opportunity. And we had done a couple of programs under the kind of the World of Opportunity name And then we decided to create Markets Wiki Education. And then my son, Tim, went to the Bonnaroo Music Festival. He was working for me one summer as an intern. And he took a week off and he took my truck. He took my precious camping gear and 10 of his friends, and he went camping in Tennessee and listened to music for a week. Came back, and Paul McCartney had been the big act that year. And I said, "What was the big deal about seeing Paul McCartney? Isn't he like 70 years old?" And he was like, "Dad, Paul McCartney was an original Beatle. He was there when rock and roll began. For me to be able to see him today, it was just really cool." And so it got me thinking that the kids of today should hear from some of the rock and roll stars from the futures and options industry, from the securities industry, who helped build the industry into what it is today. And when I was a kid working for Tom Cashman, one summer I had the opportunity to be a runner on the trading floor. And I worked for Schertz and American Express. That was a combination back then. And one day after the close, they had a stay a little day after the close, and they had some brokers and traders come and talk to all the runners and the phone clerks and explain how the industry worked and why it was important and what all the roles were and the opportunities in it and all of that. Well, you didn't have that anymore because you didn't have the runners on the trading floor or the phone clerks as much. But a lot of firms still hired interns for the summer. Some of them have more informal programs. Some of them have very formal programs where they hire just juniors, you know, that are heading into their senior years. So we created a program, the World of Opportunity, where we invited industry interns to come listen to some rock and roll stars from our industry. And we had them all deliver TED Talks. So it's a 10 to 15 minute talk about different aspects of the industry, their careers, products, whatever, to try to kind of pass on the history and their passion for the industry to the next generation. And the response to that was so overwhelming from both the firms and from the exchanges and the like that we ended up getting a contract from the CME to repeat it the next year to do it in Chicago and London. And so we did. And then we got a bigger contract the next year. It was a 3-year contract to do it in Chicago, New York, and London. That program was very successful until the pandemic kind of killed it. But we really helped inspire and educate a whole group of people for about 5 or 6 years there, that hundreds and hundreds of them who wanted to learn about more about the industry.
So what would you consider your greatest accomplishment in your career so far?
Oh, my greatest accomplishment. I think writing the newsletter every day for the last 23 years and barely missing a day is quite an accomplishment. I used to take some time off and have some guest editors. I used to let other people in the company do the newsletter from time to time. But really, for the last 13 years in particular, I've been doing it every day. So I think that's the greatest accomplishment, is just doing it every day and keeping my audience, keeping it informed, and helping the industry become more efficient by informing people, making them be able to make better decisions, helping the markets become more efficient as a result of that. You know, I've certainly helped a lot of people through the Markets Wiki Education program, through telling the stories of the industry, through all the videos that we've done with the Open Outcry Traders History Project, or the Path to Electronic Trading video series, the History of Financial Futures. All of those have been really good. All the different people that I've hired through the years and given a chance and, you know, given some guidance to and helped with their careers. You know, I think each one of those is a huge success story in different ways that I'm very proud of. And I also think that, the great staff that I have and the loyalty that I have from them is a great accomplishment because of the great work that they continue to do and show. And
that's great. And on top of your past accomplishments, what are some future goals that you have for your company?
Well, I'm not done yet. So the question is always, what do you do with something that you've built? And I wanted to build a multi-generational company. I wanted to build something that survived me. Certainly there's things that can survive me, like Markets Wiki. Certainly could have a life beyond John Lothian and Company or John Lothian. The video history stuff that we've done certainly can outlive us and all. But, you know, I want the company to continue to play a role in the industry. My next 10 years is to figure out how to make that happen and what that's going to be and what that's going to look like. I also have plans to get into the music business and help my nephew, Andrew, with his music career. And so looking to start a music label and a music publishing business and to kind of integrate those in with some of the people that we have in the company and what we do. There's some parallels to the music business and the brokerage business or the markets, as it were, in terms of their evolution from vinyl to electronic, from paper to electronic. And so I see some interesting parallels there that maybe use some of my knowledge about. But I also think that the whole music industry is still a very evolving industry and hasn't quite figured it out. And I love disruptive times and industries. And so I think it's a very interesting time to be involved. And I also think that my nephew is very talented and I want to help him develop his career, not only as a musician and songwriter, but also as a collaborator with other artists and find a way for him to be able to do that. And I have some other relatives that I want to get involved in the company. And I have a niece that's a very talented artist and a son who's a videographer, as well as my nephew, who's a videographer that works for us, that's a brother of my nephew. So there's a lot of opportunity there to do something interesting in that space. And so we're going to try to figure it out a little bit and have some fun doing it. So so you never know where the company may go just yet, you know, next.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
I would also say that I'm also very proud of all of the work that I've done with the Scouts over the years, not only at the unit level, but also at the council level, with what we've been able to do with the trading tech program and help raise some money and create opportunities. I'm a big promoter, not only of, you know, young people, but also women and opportunities for women. I'm a big promoter of philanthropy in general and the underprivileged. And so a lot of the different things that I've been involved with have tried to help those causes. And so, you know, having the platform of the newsletter has given me a great opportunity to be able to raise those causes and to raise those issues and people, and to help raise money or just help people in general. And that's been very satisfying. And whether that's been, you know, identifying somebody like Jamal Cole, who has my block, my hood, my city, the organization that he created, and doing a story about him and having the FIA then invite him to be a speaker at Expo, or identified Bevan Joseph and the Greenwood Project as a speaker for Markets Wiki Education World of Opportunity, and then having the FIA embrace the Greenwood Project and having hundreds of Black and Latinx kids get opportunities on Wall Street as a result of that. That's just really cool. And so it shows you the power of journalism and the power of what you can do with journalism. And so it's kind of like the line from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. And so with my newsletter, I have great power, and I've tried to wield that power responsibly and do good things with it. And that's why I feel pretty good about what I've been able to accomplish.